All right. Morning, all. Welcome to our Sunday school lesson. Now, if there's any extra books back there for the visitors, I think you might have a couple. If there might be some behind some on the stack there. But for those that are visiting, we have been going through the Anabaptist history course that I believe it was Faith Builders was involved in putting the book together. And this is our concluding lesson. And we have decided to combine the last two lessons. And as Nolan and I were talking about trying to wrap this thing up, I looked at the last two lessons, kind of glanced over them, and said, well, yeah, I think we can probably combine them. And after I looked at them again, I'm like, we really could split these. We really could have a whole session on each of them because all of them or both of them are very relevant. So as Nolan mentioned this morning, I was not originally scheduled to teach the closing lesson. And he texted me yesterday morning and said, hey, I got some sort of strange bug. Can you do it? Fortunately, it wasn't one of the other lessons because most of the other lessons I like to kind of study throughout the week and ended up sometimes studying most of the day Saturday just to kind of get my head wrapped around everything. But fortunately, with lesson 12 and lesson 13 is the ones we're going to be looking at, the Anabaptist witness and following Jesus today is more current day, everyday items. And so it wasn't a lot of facts and history that I had to try to wrap my head around. Before I get started, some of you don't like to read, and I've recommended a lot of books. If you don't like to read, but you want a little bit of Mennonite history or Anabaptist history, I should say, I would recommend this book. I actually want to get some, probably have them back there for you to pick up. They're fairly inexpensive. It's a good book to have on your bookshelf. It's also a good book to hand out if somebody says, so what's all this Mennonite thing, or what? You know, it's kind of a real brief overall view of where the Anabaptists started in Europe and explains the changes in the 1800s that we talked about, and also it talks about, you know, modern day Mennonites and why they have some of the practices they do, and even has a thing in the back, I think here says where to find a conservative Mennonite church, and it has a bunch of references in the back. So I would encourage you to have at least that book on your shelf if you don't have any of the others. It's something that you can easily sit down and read. Well, hopefully, as we went through these lessons, it has whetted your appetite just a little bit for the Anabaptist background in our history. Majority of us, it's our background, our history. Even if biologically it's not our history, it can be. Anybody can come in and become a child of God and join an Anabaptist church, and they can become adopted into this family. And I know for myself, just having went through a lot of the different things, now when you hear something else, it sticks because you have a basis. And so hopefully we can build off of that and continue to learn. And hopefully it's provided an appreciation for our background. All right, I'm going to see if my clicker works here. Technology is a blessing and a curse some days. It was working fine and all of a sudden didn't work, so now it works back there. So I guess we'll see whether it works back there, up here, versus Tyrell. Something came up back there. What's popping up? Just click on like the picture or something. Here we go. I think I had our own setting up here. Good. Here we go. Okay, quiz time. Y'all like quizzes, right? How many people did Conrad Grebel baptize? I'm joking. So I don't know if we even talked about, if we even know, but I did. My plan is this Sunday, it's your turn to do the talking. We're going to kind of review a lot of the questions in the book, and hopefully you can read those questions from up there. Most of the questions you can read in your book if you have the book, and I won't be looking a lot at things in the lessons, but in lesson 12, it talks about the Anabaptist witness and how the Anabaptists were witnesses. And before we actually get into that, I do want to get some input. So what was a, when you think about the series we talked about, our Anabaptist history, what are some key takeaways that you got out of the lessons that we looked at? Okay. Anything else?
Well, the curse is not there. It's interesting. Yeah, it's not original to me, but it's said that pride is the, I guess, the king of sins. I'm paraphrasing, but that's really is true. If you think of all the lessons we've studied the last few months, all the disagreements and all the crazy stuff that went on, some of them were pretty outright raising. And kind of humorous when you look back at it, but yet, I think at the basis of all that is pride. Someone believes that their version of whatever they're arguing about is the truth, and they're going to die on that hill no matter what. And a lot of times, a little bit erroneously so. I think pride kept them from being able to step back and take a view of their own life and realize what's going on. They take half a million dollars. They're willing to back down and agree with them. They're willing to agree with around you or things that aren't, you know, doctrinal issues or application or principles, you know, application principles. And I look at my own life a little bit and think about that. Pride really does play a major my part in pretty much everything that I find myself stumbling over. My inability to release self-control or desire to control a situation or desire to be able to work with another brother on something that he might not agree with me with, and you know, it's that it, pride really is the driving force behind all that.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? One of the things I thought about is God has promised there will be always be a remnant of faithful people. And you know, we looked at the Dark Ages, and before I really studied this lesson, somebody would ask me, were there really any faithful people, you know, from the time of Constantine to the Reformation? And I couldn't think of any. But we have evidence of some groups, and we looked at things, the Waldensians, and I think there were some other groups that you don't really hear much about, but it's people that had maintained a doctrine very similar to what the Anabaptists started following. So there's always a faith group. And so the important thing is, will we be part of that? So what was the difference between those who remained faithful and those who recanted or apostatized? So we looked at those that recanted under persecution. We also looked at those that kind of lost everything in the when conference drifted into worldliness. So what was the difference? What made the difference?
Surrender and devotion to God.
Complete surrender.
Love for truth.
Love for truth. I think, doesn't it start with having a personal relationship with God? When those first believers, those Conrad Grebel, Felix Mons, George Blaurock, they had a personal experience with God, and they also believed that God meant what he said in the Bible. You know, there's a lot of people that profess Christianity, but, you know, you start pointing at things in the Bible, wow, it doesn't really mean that. Or that's not for our day, that's for those people back then. So we start excusing and we're making excuses. Anything else on that before we move on? All right, so let's move into the lesson a little bit. I'm going to try to cover both lessons. I'll probably try to spend more time on lesson 13 than lesson 12. But just a couple things. I want to read a couple verses out of 1 Peter. And as we're thinking about Anabaptist witness, the Anabaptists witness to the world around them in several different ways. But 1 Peter 1, I'm going to read verses 3 to 9. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to his abundant mercy hath begotten us again unto a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen, ye love, in whom though now ye see him not, yet believing, ye rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith unto the salvation of your souls. And the whole chapter of 1 Peter here has a lot of encouragement. But I want to kind of point out verse 7 that I have up here. That the trial of your faith is much more precious than gold that perisheth. I was at an auction on Friday evening. They sold some coins. Now, they weren't anything real special. And most of them brought more than what their face value was. But if there had been a gold piece that was solid gold, it would have brought a lot of money. Why is that? It's because gold has value. And to refine gold, it takes a lot of heat and pressure. And it says here that when our faith is tried, when we go through hard times, and you know, we looked at some of our forefathers that went through severe persecution, and they endured, and they became stronger for that. You know, their persecutors were flabbergasted, you might say, because there was nothing they could do that would make them give up, even to the point of killing them. We don't like trials, at least I don't. I don't like rough times. But if we approach them with the attitude, what can I learn from this? And that this is a process of refining me, making me stronger. We can come out the other side, and once we see the get out of that, we can see that, yeah, that actually was good for me. And the whole point is that to bring praise and honor to Jesus Christ. Okay, let's just look at a couple of witnessing things. So how did the early Anabaptists witness to those around them? What methods did they use?
Wasn't
Facebook. A phrase the other day about social media? It has never made the, somebody repeated that to me, lame to walk, but it sure made the dumb to speak. So how did the Anabaptists witness?
But the quote from a paragraph on page 127 says they lived it without reproach. No lying, no deception, swearing, strife, harsh language, or intemperate eating or drinking, or outward personal display, but humility, patience, uprightness, meekness, honesty, temperance, and straightforwardness. And then this was a Catholic person quoting this, said, in such a measure that one would suppose that they had this Holy Spirit of God. But still weren't willing to say they did, but they said they acted like they did.
Suppose they did, huh? It's interesting.
I'm not sure beyond that what other things, whatever they had. One of your first questions was what takeaway. The thing that bothered me, and I don't know what to do with it, is how the evangelism, so to speak, seemed to taper off after they came to this country or this world. And what's been going on here for the last 200-300 years is what do we do with that?
Getting ready to my next question, but I'll have it here in a minute. Okay, good.
Along with that, I was reading and I thought it brought out that I never thought about, talk about like the witness seemed to not be quite as strong when it came to the New World, where they had been religiously persecuted. A lot of the different groups that came here for religious freedom. Were different groups here, but they weren't about to start persecuting someone that believed different than that because they just came from that, they experienced it themselves. They weren't going to start persecuting each other. That makes sense. I never thought about the different denominations that all were persecuted from the old country. They came over here for religious freedom. So they left each other alone. They wanted to be left alone. So you're other denominations. they didn't necessarily give a witness to that because they were just ready to be left with iron. So I think the, all the denominations may have done that, but just to get a breather and then it never changed.
It's kind of a phenomenon. It's almost like if you get on the ball and lose a bunch of weight, you got a goal and lose 25 pounds. Exercise like crazy and you eat really well, and you kind of do that, lose a pound to get your goal. It's such a big sigh of relief that it's a well documented fact. A lot of people end up getting all that again after all that hard work because it's a sense of just relaxation.
Back and relax.
I think it's what happened with the people that once again they got religious freedom, was such a relief that you kind of just you kick back and you're like, well, we're just gonna kind of pull within ourselves and just live quietly and not rock the boat because this continues. And you just kind of get a flatline.
Yeah, I think some of the message they witnessed was obviously by their godly lives, as that Catholic pointed out. Also, their suffering was a witness. You know, being burned at the stake and not giving up was a powerful witness. And of course, evangelistic testimony, whether it was going out, the Moravians were big in going out and spreading the gospel. And so, obviously, we're not persecuted physically, but I think we can still live godly lives and also give testimony. So next question, as conservative Anabaptists, do we rely too heavily on the witness of our lives without the testimony of our words? It's kind of back to the question Adrian had, are we just living, doing our thing, and don't ask me why I'm doing what I'm doing, but I just want to kind of do my thing, and that we relied too heavily on that.
Well, I would love if that was the case, because that'd be an easy way out. I just make sure I love it. It takes all the effort out of it. Don't throw up any skin in it, so to speak.
That's called appearance evangelism. Some people term that appearance evangelism. Great, and I think we've all experienced that it's a great opportunity. People are already on the street, so and so, and you may as well forget trying to come up with differences between Amish and Mennonites or all this and that. Forget all of that. Just try to point the way to Jesus Christ really quickly. And they say, oh, you good people, and I know about good baked goods. Just forget all that. Just say, we do it all because we love Jesus, And just really, it's a great opportunity. Let's don't take credit to ourselves, because of our lifestyle and culture, but rather use it as an opportunity, a great opportunity to have, point the way to Jesus.
So we were down in Florida, we stopped in a hardware store, and a fellow comes up to my wife and he goes, are you a nun? Well, right away he said, no, I'm a nun. Okay, so is that where we stop? Which interesting thing was, he claimed he was from Lancaster County. I would have thought he would have known that thing would rust. But anyway, so no, that's a good challenge. Do we tell people the real reason why we do what we do? Do we have a ready answer? I think that slide. Oh, here we go. How can we strengthen, this question's in your book, question number 3. How can we strengthen our verbal witness? And what challenges do we face in our culture that make verbal witnessing difficult? What do you think?
Both of these questions, like Grant said, we're talking about again, Facebook, that's true, is social media is just, it's a mess. But at the same time, I don't think we should discount the advantages. I think God has given us avenues to put our witness out there more than just talking to someone on the street corner. We can use it to do so. But unfortunately, everything on social media gets swamped because everyone has a voice and everything can get screamed and proved to us. And so you can easily get caught up in the mess. use social media to great effect for person testimony that I get to figure out what's going to happen. So I don't think it's something that we should just say, oh, it's just make a sweeping declaration that it's all bad, just no use at all. Because I think we need to be careful that we use the tools correctly, but also if we just discard tools, and then we run the risk of burning our talent on the ground. And this is the best.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that you can't use Facebook today. But yes, I would agree with that. There are ways that we can share our testimony today that they could.
Mm-hmm.
That's an inherent danger. Like one guy said, social media isn't. I've heard social. You can still use it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been blessed by people's sermons.
Be
a little bit sketchy too sometimes.
Yeah.
Over here. I've had to wonder what would happen if I would take some more time to prepare myself to be ready to give a word. And when Rosemary's went to New York City to evangelize, they had to take some training. And the one thing they had to do in their training was to sit down and get their story of who Jesus was to them and how he had worked in their lives. They had to get it down into like a 1 minute little package. And then at the very end, they had a little question that they inserted and they lifted back on me here to just plant that seed. So I've had to wonder if I focused enough on having a word already. Instead of freezing, like freeze or avoid, just sort of throw some mud at the wall and it sticks.
Why do us as conservative Anabaptists think it's easier to go to the mission field than to witness to our next door neighbor? How many of us know the names of our neighbors?
We're our neighbor knows too well. But that's how I find it, you know, going down to the lumber yard or something. They know me real well, you know, they know my faults. And so to talk about Jesus there, it's a little tougher than a total stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Tying this back in social media, it's one of the reasons why social media is such a wild mess, because it's very easy to be the anonymous person behind a keyboard opinion. Very easy to throw out opinions. No one really knows who you are, so they can discount or not discount anything you say. So it's much easier to go somewhere where people don't know you and say so, at least for me, it's true, that it is the people that actually know you, actually, it's a lot tougher to do that. How about this? It's a fear of man. Yeah, I think it's a couple of reasons, but it's always been puzzling to me why that is.
Is it because we tend to compartmentalize? We're him, we're doing our thing, we're working, we're making a living. Go to the mission field, that's what you do in the mission field, right? The witness. I don't know. I think that's maybe some of our trouble. Let's get the question here. We're going to have to wrap this lesson up, but I'd like to look at this a little bit. How do we weigh the impact of spending a year or two in mission work as compared to a lifetime in missions?
I don't know if it should be quite a distinct line between the two. We make it some time because, I mean, spending a year or two in mission work should be just preparing for a lifetime.
Comes back to do we view our own neighborhood as a mission field?
Yeah, he worked out well. I think sometimes it gets back to what you were saying, to compartmentalize and really, and so you say a year or two missions, and well, that's what we're going there for. We're focused in on that, and that's what. How about
God changing our heart and mindset and our focus and saying, you know what, everything we're doing here is a lifetime mission. This is why we're working. This is why we live here in this community. This is why we interact with these neighbors, because we are here on a mission. Take that same zeal and zest as you do in the 1 or 2 year thing and apply it to a lifetime of living that way.
I think too many times we have the chicken and the pig complex. And I'm sure you've all heard different versions of this story. The pig and the chicken are walking down the road. The chicken says, "Hey, pig, I think we should open up a restaurant." The pig replies, maybe. "What should we call it?" The chicken says, "How about ham and eggs?" The pig thinks for a moment and says, "No, thanks. I'd be committed, but you'd only be involved." So maybe we're too much like the chicken. Well, we want to do our thing. You know, we'll contribute. We're dedicated to help, but we're not committed. Are we all in? I thought that was a pretty good challenge. Another book for you to read. I'm sure all of you heard of Pablo Yoder. He moved to Nicaragua years ago. He's gone now. But he lived down there for a number of years. But he wrote this book, Chosen from Among the Worst. Have any of you read this book? It's a very, very well-written book, very interesting. And it's about one of the men, Omar, I think Montenegro was his name, but he was a native. And he became a convert that Pablo Yoder helped through a lot of things. He got into a lot of crime, and the U.S. actually was trying to extradite him. And miraculously, his sentence was I'm not sure what happened, but the U.S. actually, I think, not the community sentence or whatever, he never had to come to the U.S. and serve prison time. But very, very fascinating, but it's because of people on the mission field that were committed. All right, our time is getting away as usual. The last lesson, following Jesus today, and I was going to read some verses in Revelations, but I'm not going to, but the book here references Revelations 2 and 3 and talks about Jesus' message to the seven churches. I kind of skimmed over chapter 2 and 3, and there's something that really jumped out at me that I never saw before. Every single one of those churches, Jesus told them, "I know thy works." Now, we have a lot of people in our world like to say, all you need is faith, while they were saying that 500 years ago. But, you know, obviously, James tells us that, you know, works does not save us, but we need, without works, faith is dead. And so I think a lot of the things that made the Anabaptists different than those around them, the Protestants around them, was that they not only believed and had faith, but it produced actions. It produced works. And many of the Protestants believed all you had to do was believe, and you could continue on doing whatever you jolly well pleased, and it didn't make any difference. All right, let's see which of these. Let's jump to question 2 in the book. In what ways have we maintained the Anabaptist values and practices, and in what ways have we departed from them? Any thoughts on that?
Still maintain this day 5 years later, the core beliefs why they differ from them. Like churches of the day, baptism and all the core doctrines of value, doctrines of the Bible that value set them apart. It calls a lot of the people that's still the core tenets of the Baptist church.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts?
Some of the values, some of the times our value system has changed. What we're passionate about, what our heart is yearning for. We're getting, at least for me, I can see so often, I look and, you know, see the what the world can do and their value system, and I tend to start forgetting, what am I here for? Who am I really serving? So I don't know, that could be something that I can see being lost in churches today, passion for God.
Yeah, we live in a very fluid society. And when things are easy, you tend to kick back, just like when you get off that diet. Kick back and just let her coast for a while. Yeah, it's pretty easy to do that with our country we live in.
I think there's a huge difference in that. Back then, if you want to be an Anabaptist, or you want to be a follower of Jesus, there's a little cost involved. Put your life on. Today, we all, most of us have grown up in the Mennonite church, and we're kind of Anabaptists. It didn't cost us a bit much. Maybe it goes along with what Dan was saying, not very passionate about our Christian life, maybe kind of authority because of it. I don't know.
Yeah, when you became rebaptized, it was like a death sentence on your head.
I think Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, is kind of the core of some of our values, and we say we take them literally and try to live that out, but like you mentioned, our fluid society has or is affecting our thinking when we said don't take this off of what you wear, what you put on, that God will take care of you for that. It does mean something different to us than someone who's living in Sudan, you know, where you've been chased from one town to another till you have nothing but a ragged park, and you're digging for roots and drinking water out of mud puddles, you know. You don't know if you're going to live next week. You know, it's pretty certain they would read this word differently than us.
I didn't look up the statistics, but they stated in the book here that, you know, obviously we know that the U.S. is kind of an exception to not have persecution, but they claim that there is more persecution in the world than there ever was in history. You know, it's pretty easy for us to forget that, or to even comprehend that. Wanted to look at this one yet. As conservatives, how do we conserve without fossilizing? And how do we remain relevant without compromising? Pitch on either side of the road.
Isn't that basically the core question around all the other arguments and spats and splits? I mean, that's basically what everybody's trying to figure out. But it's exact questions. And every side accuses the other side of doing one of them. One side is doing the first one, the other side is doing the second. At least it's what they're supposed to claim, anyways. I don't know if there is a point we're going to answer to these questions.
Well, Any other thoughts on that? You know, you think of a fossil. What is a fossil?
Is there any life in the fossil? Fossil's dead. So if we fossilize, it means we're dead.
So is there life there? I think it's something that we all need to grapple with and something we need to be aware of, along with some of the things we discussed last Sunday. And we're not all going to come out at the same place, but can we have charity with each other? One final question, question number 7 in your book. What are specific things Jesus, who is our head, wants us, our local congregation, to do in our community? Any thoughts?
A common phrase we hear is to be his hands and feet to each person that we cross paths with.
Mm-hmm. Be the hands and feet of Jesus. Anything else?
Two words I thought of were salt and light. We add something to our community that non-Christians don't see or be able to find outside of Christianity.
And even in one of the questions we didn't have time to cover was talked about the evangelicals, you know, in what ways do the evangelicals need us and how do we need other Christians? I think the one way that, you know, being a people that actually lives out what the Bible says, I think is a powerful testimony compared to a lot of people that profess Christianity, but their life isn't really changed. In closing, I would like to read, there's two paragraphs on page 144 that I think summarize everything up real well. It says, Anabaptist churches are not perfect, nor are we the only people through which Jesus is working. But we must acknowledge with deep gratitude that he has given us a rich heritage, a heritage worth preserving. He told his first disciples, I will build my church. As we have observed his faithfulness in the past centuries, we can be assured of his faithfulness in our time. Jesus still calls men and women to follow him, and he intends that we follow him together, assembling in local bodies. This was the understanding of the early believers. It was what the early Anabaptists attempted to do, and it can be our model today. This course in Anabaptist history has provided me with a greater understanding and appreciation of my Anabaptist heritage. Those who went before me stand as a great cloud of witnesses, as the Hebrew writer says. What will I do with that knowledge? Will I use it to share with others, especially those who don't have this heritage, so that when the Lord returns, there will be many more added to his kingdom because someone was the hands and feet of Jesus who cared enough to share the gospel to the least of these.
Christian Mennonite hymnal, let's turn to number 3.